So the did you have any by this time? Had you had any personal contact with the Americans?
Oh,
had you met Americans?
Oh, one particular guest, smiling. You have to go on a U patrol, a horseshoe patrol, out one way and back the other. Take prisoners, but no fighting. No firing. Very, very fortunate. Again, we didn't meet a patrol, we'd met no enemy, and we're now coming back from the American lines. So they knew we were coming in, they expected us. We were challenged on our way into the American front line, and obviously they knew that a British patrol was coming in. We got through into their front line, and the first thing they said, "Hey, buddy, had any breakfast yet?" "No, we've got our K rations. A shoebox with a tin of fruitcake, hardtack biscuits, a sachet of tea, coffee." "You goddamn limeys, you haven't got to eat that. Come on in." "Why? And would you believe a big marquee tent in the front line? Great big marquee." Go in, all laid out. Walk by, said, what do you want then? You want ham, easy fry eggs, guess that, waffles. Never heard of waffles. Full breakfast. Sat there eating away, and never forget that to this day, the big coloured sergeant stands up. "Hey, Mac, we haven't had any ice cream for 3 whole days. Where's the ice cream?" In front line. Anyway, outside, ready to form up. And the shank come up. He said, "Are you forming up for?" "Well, we're going to march back." "March back? Yeah, we're out with the two. We're out with the firing here." I said, "What's the army caravans or whatever in the front line for?" "Man, he said, "That's the mobile brothels." I said, "Pardon?" "He said, that's the mobile brothels." I said, "Don't say no more. Don't say no more." Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah.
He didn't offer you a chance to go in the brothels.
I'm a young green soldier, ain't I? Yeah. Unbelievable. And whenever you met Americans, I say this now, if you paid for me to go to America on the most luxurious holiday of my life, I wouldn't go. Even today.
Yeah. And that's resentment.
Resentment to the highest, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
To their condition.
Their condition was that you're on this hill here, they're on the next hill, and you could see movement in the moonlight. Then you couldn't see movement. And the corporal came up, he said, "Never guess what's happening." He said, "Them blokes next door are down in the valley. They've left all their guns up there." He said, "They got cold, so they've gone down the valley to light some fires." Unbelievable. And whenever you met the Americans, he was the greatest fighter in the world. "We did this, we did that." At the Chosen Reservoir, the British Marines had to go in and help them out. They lost that battle, but they had to help them out. And in our battle here.
I mean, did you get a chance to talk to any individual Americans?
No, not really, because I say, maybe towards the end I was very bitter. Well, I am still bitter now, but in the occasion of going down the road, I believe it was outside of Seoul in those days, I flagged down by an American. So, he said, "Sorry, Mac," he said, "we thought you were the breakdown vehicle," because I was driving my Oxford carrier that towed the gun. He said, I said, "What's your problem?" He said, "We've got a Sherman bogged down in the paddy field, and we're waiting for the recovery vehicle. I don't know." So I said, "All right," I said, "got a hoser, a wire?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, put the gun." So I hooked it onto the tank. I asked the tank driver to to give him a signal to help me, we pulled the tank out of the boat. I think I seen probably 3 or 4 Yanks come up. What do you want for it? We'll buy it. How much do you want for it? We'll give you this, we'll give you that. I said, we don't do things like in the British Army. No. We used to trade with them. They used to love the fruitcake in the tins. We used soggy, hard, but very sweet. And we used to chuck all our cans in the middle. And then one of the chaps would say, right, I'm off. Away you go. You come back with Yankee cigarettes, beer, and everything. So we used to trade with them. Yeah.
So they had things you didn't have at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's different. I mean, even when they were in the front line, as I said, with one experience that we had when we come back off that patrol, but whenever you passed an American point going along the road, they used to wave, but you could see all the stuff that was going on. They were cooking, roasting. We got a heart attack. Yeah.
What about clothing? Have you been issued with proper winter clothing?
No. String vests and pants. Literally string vests. They were like, what used to call it? Knitted.
Crochet.
Mm-hmm. But big crochets. Vest and pants, and ordinary standard battle dress and overcoat. Yeah.
The Americans,
I mean, our first experience of the first winter was diabolical. About 30 to 40 below. In those days, the Han River, which is the big river that runs through Seoul, froze over. That's how cold it got. And we had our, it's a real long little bundles of hay, straw, dive into that and get a bit warm, but no, that was it. That's why General Farhawke, when he, in his recall of the years, he said, how we ever stood the cold, that we don't know. Yeah, probably because we were British. The Americans had all their big furry lined jackets and combat gear, everything, yeah.
So you must have felt very much like the underdogs.
Oh, we definitely were, yeah. I mean, there were times when you, the little naffy van used to come, believe it or not, used to come up. When we weren't in the front line, when we were back in Bieschlon, cups of tea, cigarettes and things like that. But when you went to the Americans, they'd have a PX wagon there. Anything. Want to buy it? Buy it. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Did you keep in touch with home? Did you write home at the time?
Just a couple of times, not much. No, no. I thought the less they know, the better it is. Yeah.
And did you get mail from them?
Yes, got letters from home, yes. In fact, I wrote home to my mother one time and said my hands started to split, chafing. And I couldn't get no cream, and she sent me 4 little boxes of Snowfire cream in those days, little green stuff. A little parcel arrived one day. What? Snowfire cream. Mum sent me to put on the chaps. Yeah. Yeah, it was very great.
Yeah. So, how long have you been in Korea now before the big battle?
November to April, so yeah. Mm-hmm. We'd wintered out, we'd had several skirmishes. On the particular Sunday, I came back from the burial detail, and Sergeant Austin said, pack your kit. Pack your kit, he said, you're off. I said, going to Japan. My name had come out the hat to go to Japan for an R&R, rest and recuperation. So I had 5 days in Tokyo.
What was that like?
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Was that actually in the city?
In the city, in Ginza Avenue in Main Street, Tokyo. Oh, terrific. I mean, never seen anything like him alive. No, no. Yeah, as I said, we had a very good hotel staying in, believe it or not. No kind of hotel. Lived a life of luxury for 5 days. Then I came back to battalion. And they said, am I still the driver of the... of course you are. I said, go back a little bit. I wasn't a driver in the beginning of the Oxford carrier. But somebody say, I'm going down to the petrol pool. Want to come? Yeah, I'll come. Jump in. Go 2 or 3 miles back to the petrol pool. And you have to hand pump the petrol. into the carrier. It had 240-gallon tanks on each side, one on each side. And I said, come on in, get in, drive. Come on. Anyway, cut a very long story short, Lieutenant Barker came up to me and went, Whitchurch? Yes, sir. Come with me. I said, get in the carrier. Yeah. Right, in the driving seat. Right. Okay, drive it. Pardon? Drive it. Go out, down through Main Street, Seoul, get stuck in a tram line. Skidded. All right, he said, that wasn't your fault. Got him back. He said, right, it's yours. You're the driver from now on. Yeah, unfortunately, the driver before it got killed whilst I was away and I didn't know it. I said, what's happened to him? I can't remember. Oh, he said, he got killed on the last patrol while you were away. So I became the driver. Yeah, with the tank crew up there. Yeah, that was my driving, that was my first introduction to drive. I could drive the thing anyway, so it didn't make a difference, but I was now officially a driver.
What was the Oxford carrier like?
Oh, terrific. I've got a young man here in Bristol. I've got to go and bike up. I've got to go and take a fighting patrol, because, as I say, tank warfare was out. Take a fighting patrol out. So I went down to particular company, D Company, and this particular chap lives in Bristol, Frank Bisp. Hello, man. I said, oh, are you Frank? He said, you're taking a patrol out? I said, yeah. He said, where's the best place to sit? He said, I'm a little bit chilly. So I said, oh, sit at the back on top of that plate. Sit on the top here. So he goes back, sits up, and we're now going up, and we've got to get over this hill to get out. And I'm virtually climbing like that. Anyways, they all hang on. And he called me all the names under the sun. I said, what the hell's the matter with you? He said, I've been a burnt my ass. He said, I'll have play. He still says it today, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were they four-wheel drive?
No, it was track vehicles. Yeah, I've got a photograph up there. Yeah.
Were they easy to
drive? They were... not steering wheels, they were tillers, push and pull. They had 12 forward gears and 12 reverse gears for power. They were very maneuverable and very powerful. Yeah. Used to say, I used to be a conveyor of personnel.
And what was Lieutenant Barker like?
Oh, I love you, chap. Yeah. Very potted face. But ever so nice man. He always used to come around and say everything all right. And we'd been out on a fighting patrol. Come back in, mudded up to the eyebrows, and this little pipsqueak of an officer came up. Sergeant, pull your men into line. Pulled into line. Port rifles for inspection. Port rifles comes along. Put that man on charge. Dirty rifle. Put that man. Sergeant said, excuse me, can I have a word? Now, by the time I could see Barker come up the road. So he stood there and listened to the conversation, obviously he heard what was going on. Sergeant, dismiss your men. So he called this little pipsqueak and took him down the corner, like he said, but we never seen the pipsqueak afterwards. Yeah. Coming off a fighting patrol, you've got a dirty rifle. I never knew what happened to Barker, actually, but I did see him later on in the newsreel. Because although his name's in the Roll of Honour, I never did know what happened to him. So he was one of the lucky ones. Yeah. Yeah.
So the patrols went on.
Yes, no, patrols were on and on and on. We now pull up into Gloucester Valley, as it's now called. Today it's totally different today because it's a main road goes through there. But in those days, the entrance to Solmary, which was the little village that was inside the valley, the entrance was through over a little bridge, over a stream, through a gap that probably a 3-ton lorry could just about get through this gap, but in the mountains. And then the valley opened up down to the down to the Indian River.
Had you had much contact with the Korean population?
Oh yes, lovely people.
Really?
Used to trade with them.
Right. Where did you meet them? When you
actually sort of out just outside villages, you have to bed down, and they would come down and try and talk to you. Some could speak English, obviously, but when they found that we were British, they would talk more to us than they would the other people. So, yeah. And they used to get 50 cigarettes a day. You shoot in a tin, yeah, in a tin that could open like, and a rum ration. Kind of, I don't know. A rum ration to keep the cold out. Yeah, but me being almost a non-smoker in those days, I never used to smoke all that. 50 a day, I couldn't smoke 50 a day. So we traded with the South Koreans and different things.
What did you buy off them?
Potatoes of all things. Yeah,
we got. Oh
yes. Oh, yeah. Cooking. Yeah, great. Cooking was a very dangerous thing because. A 3-foot army shell case, ends knocked out, was a stove fired by a 5-gallon drum of petrol. Now, to heat this cooker, you puncture a hole in the bottom of a 5-gallon can and place that over a fire that was in the hole, creating a jet of pressured petrol. You would ignite that. Do your cooking, whatever you wanted. You had cans of rolled bacon in the can, so that would go on. Beans, heat it up or eat it cold. But if somebody shouted, go, you didn't stand. You didn't look around, you went, because this 5-gallon drum was just about to explode. Okay, it's been so combusted.
So, did you ever see any accidents?
Not accidents as such, no. There were plenty of. Oh, it was. I mean, I was. When you look back on it, you think, "Oh, the hell did we do that?" Yeah, because of the combustion, the 5-gallon drum would explode like a bomb. Not all the time, but occasionally it would happen. Yeah.
But there's a strange sort of strong desire to cook something.
Oh yes, yes.
People do the most amazingly foolish.
Oh yeah, I mean.
Don't they? I suppose you were young men.
Yeah, we were young men.
Hungry.
Yes,
and
I mean. Well, we used to, if we went into a village, and obviously, in those days they had meat shops, not butchered meat shops, and you bartered to get different steaks or whatever. But that was natural food to the Americans. I mean, they would have steaks issued. We had to barter for ours. Yeah. Did we say we go through one particular village, and in the centre of the village is a blown-out music shop. But in the music shop is an organ, only about a 3-foot organ, bellows. So I stop the tank, I stop the carrier, and Jack Sheldrake comes from Salisbury, very musically minded. He says, "Oh, there's an organ over there." I said, "Oh, yeah, but," I said, "would it work?" So we went out through the shop, got the use of it, and Jack played everything on his organ. It sounded lovely. Yeah, great. That is unbelievable. Yes, they did, because they could hear the music. And when they came in, realised, although we weren't playing, obviously, not their type of music, we were playing Western music, they were quite happy. They clapped at the end. Yeah, yeah. One soul-destroying thing was the end, coming through these other villages. We'd been fired upon, and they decided to go investigating. So they hiked out all the villagers. Oh, poor. Some 50 to 60 villagers. Yeah, brought them out of all the villages and stuck them in the school playground. Put your machine gun up. I said, yeah, put your machine gun up, he said, and if one of them moves, he said, no, the lockdown. If I fire this gun, I can't hit them anyway. It's fine. It was just a show.
Yeah.
But they did capture a few Chinese in the end, yeah. But anyway, out searching around the paddy fields. They found a couple of them, brought them in, took them back as prisoners of war. You know.
I mean, it sounds as though you were often asked to bring in prisoners. They wanted to
Oh, they wanted information. That was it. If you could take them alive, take them. If you can't, then, well, obviously, yeah. The other thing happens.
What did you think of the Chinese as fighters?
In the beginning, when we were settled in Gloucester Valley, we were in there for a few days. Well, 3 or 4 weeks, actually. And we go across the Imjin River into uncharted territory on patrols. But of course, you couldn't get off the road, you had to follow the roads. And I had this patrol with me, and it was in a convoy. We had tanks, air support, everything. And we went 40 miles and didn't meet a thing, didn't see a thing. Yet something 4 days later, made you back. Yeah, first Chinese I ever saw was a couple of prisoners that they came in with. I mean, I hadn't been out fighting that particular time, but they brought these Chinese notes that were, you know, you could see they were different colored and things. It was probably the first time I ever seen a Chinese. South Koreans, not a great deal of difference in facing and coloring and things. In fact, you probably, if you put a North Korean or a Korean in with a Chinese, you probably have a job to pick them out. You can tell the difference. Again, if I can go back to the beginning of the battle on the Sunday, again, report to D Company, take a fighting patrol down to the river because they're expecting something. They knew they were coming, but they didn't say. So I went down and picked this company up and I got down to the river. It was probably 2 miles away across the plains. So I dropped the patrol off, and the officer said, "All right," he said, "you've no need for you to stay." He said, "We're staying overnight." He said, "We'll call you up in the morning on radio and ask you to come and pick us up again." Well, it never happened, did it? Never happened. I got back to my resting place where I was, and I always used to sleep in the carrier, cover it over, sleep in it. Again, my mate Jack shot right bang on the side of the carrier. "You wait," I said, "I'm no. Come and listen to this. Listen to the radio." And there was no format or uniform on the radio. "They're coming. They're coming. There's thousands of them coming. We've killed a few, but we've got to get back. We're going to make our own way back." And there was no over and out, Charlie, over, things like that. It was just... So, sergeant said to me, he said, "No," he said, "you're not going down." He said, "You won't stand a chance down there on that road." He said, "They've got the road, they've covered it." And of course, as you know, there is some discrepancy in the amount of Chinese that came into us. We know there were two armies, and the armies were estimated at 30,000. And you're looking at 900 of us. Fighters, you kill one, and another one come in his place. They'd run amok. And we always said afterwards that other people wouldn't have done what they did. They ran into machine gun fire. They had box machine guns, crossfire. So anything that comes in within that box area is dead. And they kept coming and coming and coming. Closest we ever got to them was from some 15, 20 feet away. That's the actual closest I got to them. But fighters, I wouldn't call them a good fighter. I call them idiots because no man would have done what they did. Whether they were doped or anything, I don't know. But when the order came towards the end of the battle, fixed bayonets was one thing I dreaded. Because going back to the time I joined the army, bayonet practice was always a bad thing for me because I always got killed. I always picked the wrong bloke and got killed.
In what way?
In practicing.
Yeah.
Stuck with a bayonet.
Oh, right, yeah.
I mean, I had no chance.
You always got stuck.
I always got stuck with a bayonet. Oh, right, the bayonet had the scabbard on for protection, of course. But I always ended up being killed. So now we've got orders to fix Bayonet. And I'll tell you what, I couldn't have moved it. But anyway, we fixed Bayonets. But they didn't get that far. Although they came close to us, they didn't come close enough. Because by now we're running out of ammunition. And the order came through, make your own way out. The battle was always almost over. We'd lost a battle. We'd run out of ammunition. They did an airdrop to us a couple of days before. Didn't come nowhere near us, the airdrop. Although the actual battle was very fierce and intense from probably the first day onwards. But even now today, there was a river that they had to cross. There was the plains they had to cross. And in today's world, that lot would have been wiped up before they even got across the river.
You were on a rifle then?
The gun came into it in the end, but that was only the fire of the high explosive shells that they had. Mm-hmm. Point blank.
17 pounder,
yeah.
Pardon? 17 pounder wasn't deployed before in battle.
No, as I say, we didn't fire it. No. Yeah. But my sergeant came up to me, he said, how many shells you've got? I said, what do you want? AP, armor piercing. HE, high explosive. He said, I'm interested in AP. I said, I've got 20 high explosive shells. He said, right. Positions your gun down the road, he said, point blank. So we did that, fired out.
And what were you able to hit?
Anything that came in the corner. Troops.
Yeah.
You ricocheted off the rocks to make an explosion.
You see troops coming around.
Yeah. I've got a recording that my wife doesn't like of Zulu, the film Zulu, because when you marry the two together, you're in a valley with Zulu. You've got the masses of Zulus walking over the hills, and that's how it is. From here down to the bottom road, and you can see them in their hordes. Yeah.
So you were able to fire the
17 pounder. Yeah, we got Then Aura came round to smash the firing pin that fires the gun. Take it out, smash it so it couldn't be used. We've all run out of ammunition. We've got every man for himself. My sergeant said, disable your gun. So I went down and disabled the gun. He said, disable your carrier. Oh, can I disable the carrier? I can't blow it up. A couple of air grenades in the right position with the pins out. Whether they ever got used, I don't know. Pulled the pins and put them in strategic position so if anybody got in there. It was so quick, you couldn't do really. I mean, the best thing I would have done was put something to explode the petrol, all the petrol, but it didn't happen. No. So at the end, I came up with. Who is now General Sir Far Hockley. He was Captain Far Hockley in those days. And we came out with...
He
was just... He'd taken over patrol. And when I got down the bottom of the hill, bumped into his patrol, went with his patrol, we'd go down the valley. He said, if we can make it over that next saddle hill, he said, over the hill, he said, we should be all right. We didn't get that far. No, not really. All right, you were probably frightened, but you wouldn't panic. No. I mean, you were still ready to fight whatever happened, even though I had no bullets. You were still ready to do unarmed combat. And in the end, when we got down the valley, before we got out of the actual road out of the valley was obviously the wrong way to go, so we went that way up over the top, and they just waited for us like fish in a barrel. Fired a few shells, killed a few, and Far Hockley said, if you want to live, smash your weapons. He said, if you want to die, keep going. So we decided we wanted to live, so we smashed the weapons and put our hands up.
Ben Whitchurch, End of Reel 3.